Hello and welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Jameson Winter, and I am the Dean of the Upper School at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee, and I'm joined today by Josh Edgren.
Hi, I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. Jameson, what are we talking about today?
Today, we are talking about The Lord of the Rings for the first time officially with a dedicated episode. I wanted to think through Bilbo and Frodo's relationship a little bit and kind of hone in on it because I was considering recently, we've talked a lot about fathers, what would be a good father figure from The Lord of the Rings to talk about and just kind of get into his character. And I realized...
Other than Denethor, obviously.
Right. I realized as I contemplated it, okay, you've got Denethor, he's a father, but you don't actually have that many fathers in The Lord of the Rings, and you don't have that many direct father figures. There may be aspects here or there, but where you have a father-son relationship, you get maybe Théoden with Éowyn is a good kind of father-daughter relationship, and to some extent with Éomer, but you don't see much of that between the two of them. So I wanted to start just by asking, what are other maybe aspects of father figures that you see in bits and pieces along the way before we get into Bilbo and Frodo?
It's striking when you mentioned that, and I thought, no, surely there's got to be, no, but wait, there kind of isn't, right? As far as direct fatherhood, you mentioned Denethor, you mentioned Théoden, but you're right. There are spiritual fathers in some respects. You could argue that Gandalf is a father to everybody, but is that really true? Hard to say. I think personally that Aragorn is a father figure, particularly to the hobbits, from Bri onwards in some respects, but then to Merry and Pippin, particularly later. Elrond, but that's very minor. Elrond's role as father is pretty minimal in the trilogy itself. Yeah, can you think of any others?
I think that's basically it. I mean, there may be a couple of others who you could say these are just good men and they would be good fathers. I've done a little bit of digging online just to see what people think about father figures in The Lord of the Rings. Some people say Sam, and like, okay, great, but that's after the book closes.
Whatever.
You sort through the appendices, and you don't really get anything there from him as a father. You know that he will be a good father. Interestingly, I saw a list of several quotes that Sam has from the gaffer, things that his father has said to him
over the
years, and it's really funny.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because I think you can just look at the fruit of his raising Sam and say he did a good job. But all of the things that Sam says are like little kind of slights or the gaffer picking at Sam and pointing out his faults in the moment. So they're like, the gaffer seems like a terrible father. And people are like, no, look at Sam. Like, he did a great job. This is his son.
That's really interesting. And I hope we get into that a little bit more, the comparison and contrast between Bilbo Frodo and gaffer Sam. Because I had never thought about those are... Like, the gaffer follows Sam like Bilbo follows Frodo throughout the trilogy.
Right.
That's really interesting. Not to stretch things too far, but I actually think you can make an argument for Treebeard being a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even a stronger argument than Gandalf in some respects. The way he takes the Merry and Pippin in, the way he's a shepherd, the way he is pining for his lost family. In some respects, longing for the return of the Entwives, longing for the Entings. So I think there's something there, too.
He is one that comes to mind specifically for Merry and Pippin, in a way, even, I think, more than Aragorn, more than Gandalf, like you said.
Sure.
Because he's maybe, first and foremost, the one who kind of awakens their virtue in the story. And that's the moment in the story where they really start to mature. And then later, obviously, you have Théoden to Merry. Merry says, you've been like a father to me, obviously. And Pippin sees Denethor and Barragond and Gandalf all in various lights as kind of drawing his virtue out in different ways when he's in Minas Tirith at the end. But Treebeard kind of starts that process for them in maybe the most profound way. I mean, even literally, they drink the Ent draft and grow physically. And so they're maturing through that process. And I think he also is closer to them than Aragorn really gets to Frodo or Sam, because they have such little time together compared to the rest of the journey. He might be the second one that I go to, but then Bilbo and Frodo, I think, is probably the clearest picture to me of a father figure, and especially a father-son relationship. I think you can do a lot with Théoden and Éowyn, obviously, but that's just different.
The more I think about it, second to Bilbo Frodo, I think I would probably go to Théoden, because he is a father to his people. And I think that that theme is stronger and more explicit with regard to Théoden Éowyn, Théoden Éomer, Théoden Merry. I think that's more in line with what Tolkien's trying to do.
And it's interesting that they're both adoptive fathers, right? These aren't their literal children.
Yes.
You have Bilbo and Frodo, who are cousins. Obviously, Éowyn and Éomer, niece and nephew. But Bilbo and Frodo are cousins. They affectionately call each other uncle and nephew throughout the book, but they're, whatever it is, first cousins twice removed or second cousins one time removed, either way, right? It's a little bit of a complex relationship.
Right. I forget what the exact is. Yeah. Jameson, before we get too much farther, can you share a little bit more about your experience with The Lord of the Rings? Because it's more than just, I read it when I was 14 and I really liked it. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I did read it when I was maybe in high school, maybe middle school, which I think that's probably right because I forgot so much of it until I read it again in college. But since then, I've read it 6 or 7 times over the last 5 or 6 years because I teach it now every year to 6th grade. We read Lord of the Rings at school with them and they read it 10 pages at a time every night. It is, yeah, I love it. And we just talk about it as they read it. They come to class, they've done their reading, hopefully, and we discuss it. I try to focus in on certain scenes and ask them questions about it. Hey, why did this character do that? What do you think about it? You know, is that virtuous? Should we imitate that? Is it wrong for him to act that way or say that? Those sorts of things. And it leads to such good discussion. I mean, the more I read it with them, the more I see in it. And then also the more I realize how much there is, how broad Tolkien's scope is in speaking about virtue and the Christian life and all of these things through his storytelling. It's really just remarkable and wonderful.
So you stew on this book every year. You take 11 and 12 year olds through it day by day, page by page, like the whole year is The Lord of the Rings?
Almost. It takes us at least through February. This year, I think we finished in April because we missed so much school and got behind with several things. Yeah, so it takes most of the year reading it just a little bit at a time every day.
That's so great. And it's such a neat age to read that book as. It's you know, very much a coming-of-age story in some respects, friendship, questing, et cetera, et cetera. So you're the expert here. I hope that I will catch the pearls of wisdom as they fall from your lips.
All right. Well, I don't know about that, but we can certainly discuss it together. So my thesis is just narrowly focusing on Bilbo as a father. He's an adoptive father. He brings in Frodo as his heir at the beginning of the book. And you actually don't get much of their relationship, much of their life together. It kind of skips big swaths of time over a decade between when he comes at, you know, to be his heir and then the birthday party, that's the first chapter. When he's 33, Bilbo turns 111, 111, as he says. And even though you don't get the background, you don't get all of the scenes of little Frodo becoming a man in Bilbo's house, you clearly see that he's seeking to follow in Bilbo's footsteps along the way, right? He's not just seeking to inherit the wealth or something. It maybe is worth noting if somebody hasn't read it or if you've only seen the movies, right? Frodo's parents die when he's young. And so that's why he comes and lives with his cousin Bilbo, who adopts him. But they clearly share this kind of father-son love for one another in the books. You can see that in many ways. One of my favorites is that throughout Frodo's journey, there are these constant callbacks to things that Bilbo taught him or things that Bilbo said or a poem that he wrote that's fitting, or he just thinks about wanting to see Bilbo. You know, even in the scouring of the Shire, Frodo says, oh wait, we can't do that yet. I need to go see Bilbo first. I won't delay going to Rivendell to see Bilbo again after the journey ends. That's how much he loves this hobbit who has adopted him and taught him so much of what he knows.
Can you talk about the significance of Bilbo adopting Frodo as his heir? So that's significant narratively because of the humorous side plots with the Sackville Bagginses. But can you talk about that? Why does Bilbo have to adopt Frodo? Couldn't he just be a beloved cousin?
I suppose he could. You know, you could write the story differently. Would it be as good? I would say no. One of the clear patterns in the story, there's even this, we don't have to go into it too much, there's this detail that you can trace out with the ring as a gift, the ring as a present, because Bilbo yes. claims it as a gift, so does Gollum. He doesn't claim it as a gift, I suppose. He claims it as, you know, this is something that I won in this contest, right? But he gives it as a gift on his birthday, Bilbo's own birthday, to Frodo, who receives it as a gift, in some sense, both for his own birthday and for Bilbo's birthday, which, you know, the hobbits do this weird thing where they give gifts to other people on their own birthday. So it's kind of strange that they share a birthday. This is his inheritance legally because he's his heir. He's passing the ring on along with Bag End and all of the treasure and the wealth and things like that that Bilbo has stored up over the years, which is maybe a little overblown by the hobbits in the Shire. They think he's got mountains of gold inside his hobbit hole. Nevertheless, you know, he leaves all of these things to Frodo, but the only thing that matters, the only thing that he keeps as an inheritance is the ring. And that's a huge moment in the story. We'll come back to it, but the fact that Bilbo willingly, kind of at the pushing of Gandalf, at the encouragement of Gandalf, that he willingly gives over the ring rightfully and legally to Frodo, I think is a huge device that Tolkien plays with in the story.
He's the only one up until this point in the ring's history to give up the ring willingly, which is underappreciated when we're considering Bilbo's character.
In fact, I would argue he's really the only one that gives it up willingly. You could include Sam, sort of, because he's a ring bearer for a short moment.
Sam.
Yeah. But at the same time, he recognizes that it's not fully his, even if you include him, right? He doesn't own it by right. He's merely picking it up to continue someone else's quest that he thinks they can't fulfill, right? He thinks Frodo won't be able to do it, so he takes
it.
That's
a good point.
It's not kind of like, you know, Frodo, Bilbo, Gollum. They all want this rightful claim to the ring. And we don't really get that in the text with Sam. He's not seeking to put his claim to the ring beyond doubt, whereas all of the others do at some point. So that's
a good point.
That's why, you know, you could include Sam in there, but it's a different kind of giving up the ring even than Bilbo does, because he owns it, you know, by right in some respect. So that's I think the big reason that it's important that Frodo is literally Bilbo's heir. But I think it's more than that. It's also, what does it mean to adopt someone as your son, right? What does it mean to bring someone into your family and become his father? It doesn't mean that you're related by blood, obviously, although these are, right? They're cousins. But it doesn't mean you're literally related by blood. Okay, so what does it mean that I am now your father and you are now my son? Well, it means that I am taking upon myself the responsibility willingly, knowing who you are. I'm bringing you into my family and taking upon myself the responsibility to raise you and equip you to walk in manhood or womanhood, you know, if you adopt a daughter, right? That's what being an adoptive parent is. And Bilbo is doing that and instilling the kind of virtue and character in Frodo that he needs to complete his quest, which is really kind of the meat of what I want to talk about today.
No, that's interesting. I'd never thought about the idea of legal adoption being, I'm going to prepare you to take my mantle, right? But there's an interesting connection. In ancient Rome, this was the practice of the emperors. Almost never did the power of the emperor, the authority of the emperor, pass to a biological son. But it almost always passed through a legal son. Because if the emperor was a decent emperor, at the end of his life, he would adopt his heir. And you have funny situations where sometimes this meant he was adopting a man older than himself, right? Or in weird cases, but there was this legal continuity that was being established, and ideally it was an older emperor adopting a younger man so that he could then groom and prepare. So it's almost like that's what's going on with Bilbo and Frodo. Bilbo is legally committing to prepare Frodo to take on his mantle, even though Bilbo doesn't know what that will mean. He doesn't know that's going to mean going to Mordor, but he does it anyways.
He doesn't have to know, in some sense, what the specific quest will be for Frodo. That's not what any of us need to know as fathers. We need to know what kinds of sons, what kinds of daughters they need to become. And so Bilbo doesn't know that the ring is Sauron's until after it's left his possession. And then he's like, well, if Gandalf would have told me this years ago, I could have done something about it then, right? When he was young. And I love those funny little
hop,
quips.
Hop, skip, and a jump down to the cracks of doom.
Yes, that's right. I love those little quips. Like, Bilbo is such a funny character when you pay attention to his dialogue. When he writes the song about Aragorn, I chuckled at this when I listened to it with the boys in the car the other day. In Rivendell, right after the feast, he writes a song about Aragorn. And Aragorn comes and helps him a little bit, and then he's talking to Frodo after. He's like, hey, can you guess which lines were mine and which ones were Aragorn's? And he says, I don't want to guess. And he says, well, never mind anyway. It was all mine except for this little bit about a green stone that I didn't understand, but Aragorn thought was really important.
And then he
has this line about Aragorn saying something like, you know, if you have the cheek to write a song about Arendelle and the House of Elrond, then, you know, I'm not going to have anything to do with it, essentially. Like, you go at it. And so Bilbo's like, okay, maybe I am a little cheeky here to write this grand song about things above me. Anyway, you know, just, he's a very funny character. I love that about him. But back to Frodo, he doesn't need to know what Frodo is going to have to do. He understands something, really, this is the point of the story, right? He understands what the hobbits don't understand. He understands that there's a world out there beyond us that has much to teach us and that we're a part of. And we need to be a part of. He goes off and slays this dragon that has nothing to do, helps slay the dragon. Okay, he didn't shoot the arrow.
He doesn't even touch the dragon. But he's involved.
Yeah.
He's involved in the whole
story.
Without
him, it doesn't happen, right? Because he goes, he spies out the dragon. He sees the weak spot. He's involved in shaping kingdoms in the world that have nothing to do with the Shire directly. And he recognizes hobbits have a place in this world, which is the whole lesson that the hobbits learn by the end of the story. The scouring of the Shire is the point of the story in so many ways. The hobbits have to leave and come back and put their own house in order. And it's by getting the hobbits to participate in the scouring and participate in overthrowing an unjust ruler that they come to maturity in the world and they come to fulfill their place in the world. I mean, you can even, there's so much biblical imagery here, right? With the temptation in the garden and Adam should have exercised dominion and rule over the serpent through the temptation. That's in some sense what the hobbits are doing. For the first time, they have this oppression come in and they're exercising dominion over their own land. It's a beautiful picture. Bilbo gets that in a very small way for himself and trains Frodo to be that kind of hobbit. Right. What are some ways that you think of when you think of, you know, Frodo as a young little hobbit in Bilbo's house? What are some ways that you see him being trained up in this way, in an adventurous kind of spirit that the hobbits don't typically possess?
One thing that I'm trying to remember, does Bilbo actually take Frodo out of the Shire?
Oh, let's see. Let's see. He definitely goes out to the edges of the Shire. I just read that with the boys. So like, it's not his first time to cross the Brandywine, for instance, and that sort of thing. I don't remember if there's any specific account of, you know, we went outside the Shire. He certainly doesn't go to Rivendell, right? He certainly doesn't go that far.
Or the Lonely Mountain or anything like that. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because whether or not Bilbo takes Frodo outside the Shire, he certainly gives him a sense of the wider world. In the first place, he tells him his stories. So he tells him the stories of his adventure and writes them down for Frodo. So Frodo is well-versed in Bilbo's own adventures and understands kind of why they were important. He also, Frodo knows and has met elves before. Yeah, because Gildor has met him before, right?
Gildor has not met him before, but he knows who Frodo is and has heard of him. But he has met elves, certainly. That's true. And he knows the elvish language, right? He knows the elvish language. He knows these poems and songs that Bilbo has either made up or sings about the world, all of these sorts of things. I mean, they adventure through fields and forests together. He goes on long walks through the Shire, exploring the wilderness kind of around them.
Yeah, but even just the fact that he teaches him the elven tongue is incredibly significant. Right. But then also shaping his soul with these stories and poems and whatnot. The more I think about it, the more I just see what Bilbo gives Frodo is himself. That's what he gives him. He gives him his stories. He gives him his poems. He gives him his love for language, his adventurous spirit. He gives him his knowledge. He teaches him to love what Bilbo loves. And you talked before about how Bilbo doesn't know what the quest is going to be. He doesn't even necessarily know there is going to be a big world-shaping quest, but what he gives him is himself. And I think that ends up being what Frodo needed. And that's just a marvelous lesson for dads. Like, we don't know what quests our children are going to have to go through, right? We don't know if your son's going to join the Marines or if he's going to go be a pastor in a country church. So we can't prepare them for every contingency. All we can give them is ourselves. All we can give them is our own loves, right? And pray that our loves are ordered. And so it's striking seeing Bilbo's influence his love for poetry, his love for story, his love for the woods and fields of the Shire being what sustains Frodo in the quest and gives him something to long to return to as well.
That's right, because he, as you said, passes in some sense his own character, his own values on to Frodo, and then understands and in fact expects Frodo to do something with it. Maybe not a world-changing thing when he doesn't know about the ring yet, right? But he expects Frodo to do something with it. Maybe slaying a dragon, maybe not, who knows? But he says again and again, this is our book, right? The book that you're talking about that he writes. He's recording the events of The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings, right? By Frodo Baggins. He's recording these things even when Frodo gives an account at the Council of Elrond of his doings. He says, Bilbo later says, I've taken notes on it and I'm going to start putting it into our book. He calls it our book because he recognizes this is a book that's about my life that I'm giving to you, but it's really a record of our time in Middle Earth and what we do, because he sees him as so united to Frodo, importantly. And so let's just kind of transition towards that quest then. You can see what you were talking about, this idea that Frodo has become like Bilbo. I think the first place you really clearly get it in a big way and maybe start to recognize the importance of who Bilbo is at the Council of Elrond, right? Elrond is talking about destroying the ring. They've finally come to this decision to destroy the ring, not to hide it, not to use it, not to try to send it over the sea. Don't give it to Tom Bombadil. He's just going to forget about it and leave it somewhere, right? He says, I've got a little quote here. This quest may be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong. Yet such oft is the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere. And man, what a quote. Like this chapter of the book, so full of rich wisdom. Tolkien's writing is just chock full of wisdom. I love it. But then the response to this, you know, this idea that these small people are moving the world, moving the wheels of the world, because the eyes of the great are elsewhere, focused on, in some sense, big problems, but you know, maybe some of the biggest things happen to fall to small hands sometimes. Bilbo says this, very well, Master Elrond, said Bilbo suddenly. Say no more. It is plain enough who you are pointing at. Bilbo, the silly hobbit, started this affair, and Bilbo had better finish it, or himself. I was very comfortable here, and getting on with my book, if you want to know. I am just writing an ending for it. I had thought of putting, and he lived happily ever afterwards to the end of his days. It is a good ending, and none the worse for having been used before. Now, I shall have to alter that. It does not look like coming true. And anyway, there will evidently have to be several more chapters if I live to write them. It is a frightful nuisance. When ought I to start? And I love that moment in the story because Bilbo is showing...
It's wonderful.
He's showing his character, right? He's showing who he is, that he's the pithy old hobbit who is old enough to tell you exactly what he thinks all the time, kind of like the gaffer we mentioned earlier, right? And yet he recognizes everything's not a joke. There are serious things happening in the world and I have a part to play in them. And that's one of the biggest things that he passes on to Frodo. It's just delightful.
And his casual willingness to do the impossible quest, his almost his flippancy with like, I'm going to die, but well, you know, got to do what I got to do. Is quintessential hobbit, which you see in all of them, right? This superficial joviality, the superficial silliness hiding this deep self-sacrificial
yes.
courage. And you see it with Bilbo, and then you ultimately see it with all the others.
Boromir sees it, right? The next line is, Boromir looked in surprise at Bilbo, but the laughter died on his lips when he saw that all the others regarded the old hobbit with grave respect. Only Gloin smiled, but his smile came from old memories, right? So Boromir's about to kind of laugh
That's
and
great.
Mock at the idea of Bilbo taking the ring, and then he stops short because he looks at the reverence that all the others in the council have for Bilbo, and they understand who he is, what he's done, and that he's being serious, right? That he is willing to sacrifice himself at whatever age now. I could do the math, but I won't. He's past 111 for sure. You know, over a decade has passed since the birthday at the beginning of the book. I think 13 years maybe. So he's, you know, 124 or so. And yet he's willing to go. He's willing to do it. You know, at this frail old age, he'll sacrifice whatever it takes. So I think we see that very intentionally from Tolkien in the next page. I'll read this paragraph because it's so powerful. This is a scene that we focus on a lot with the students at school, and it's riveting every time you contemplate it. They've essentially said, you know, we've got to find somebody to go to this, you know, go on this quest. Who's it going to be? No one answered. The noon bell rang. Still no one spoke. Frodo glanced at all the faces, but they were not turned to him. All the council sat with downcast eyes, as if in deep thought. A great dread fell on him, as if he was awaiting the pronouncement of some doom that he had long foreseen and vainly hoped might after all never be spoken. An overwhelming longing to rest and remain at peace by Bilbo's side in Rivendell filled all his heart. At last, with an effort, he spoke and wondered to hear his own words, as if some other will was using his small voice. "I will take the ring," he said, "though I do not know the way." Right, and you see that quintessential hobbit courage and self-sacrifice that is in some ways small, but in other ways goes down to the depth of the reality itself.
And you see that looking back to Bilbo in his thought process there, he longs to be back with Bilbo. He doesn't want to leave home, right? He doesn't want to leave the fireside, but he's got to go. And one of the reasons he's got to go is because Bilbo went, and now Bilbo's passed the mantle. And so in order to be a faithful son, he's got to go.
You know, this is neither here nor there, but one thing I just realized as you were speaking is that they're both going into a fiery doom, that Frodo's literally going to the cracks of doom, this volcanic mountain, and Bilbo goes into the dragon's den, this mountain filled with fire.
Yeah, fiery mountain both ways. Yeah, that's right.
You know, Tolkien knows what he's doing here. Obviously, that even that symbolism is clear, and that's on his mind presently as he's writing. And there's such a depth to it. You can read it 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 times and still be plumbing new depths in the story and richness in the meaning that Tolkien has put into it. But this last thing, as Frodo accepts the quest, there's one final way I think that Bilbo kind of prepares him to go out and sends him into the world. You can think about like a father sending his son out into the world as he becomes a man. He bequeaths on him his sword and his mithril vest, right? His two closest treasures in the world. This sword that he has used to slay spiders and to defend his friends and to fight against the darkness. And this mithril vest that was given to him as a token, as a reward for his faithfulness to his friends. You know, even after the event where he steals the Arkenstone and all of this, right? He steals, you know, that even might be the wrong word. But Thorin recognizes his value and gives him this kingly gift that's recorded as being worth more than the Shire itself, right? And Bilbo never knows how valuable it is. So he sends Frodo out with these tools and equips him for his journey.
Which is, again, a quintessential father move. So he's given his son himself. He's given his son practical training, as in elvish language, stories, poems. But then he also gives tools. And not just tools, but precious tools. And just like he's given, this is also really interesting. In some sense, every father does this, right? Every father passes on a burden and also tools and gifts, right? And so Bilbo passes on to Frodo the burden of the ring, but also the tools he ends up using to take the ring to Mordor. One thing that I hadn't ever thought about before is, or at least not this to this extent, this is new thought for me, but the ways that Frodo's quest follows the same beats as Bilbo's, but amplified. So they both go to Rivendell. They both go to Rivendell somewhat in haste. They both go from Rivendell down underground, but one is in the Goblin Town and the other is to the Mines of Moria fighting a Balrog, right? So that's an amplification. Then they both go out and they have a period of respite. Right, so House of Beorn and Lothlorien, but I'd rather be in Lothlorien than the House of Beorn. Maybe. So there's an amplification there as well. And then both encounter spiders, but the spider that Frodo encounters is not the same as the spiders that Bilbo encounters. Right? There's no Adderkop going on in Shelob's lair, and then ultimately ending in a fiery mountain. There's also the sense of Bilbo being alone. He has to go alone to free the dwarves from the Elven King's palace, and also, you know, the barrel hole incident. Frodo has to go alone away from his companions, but he gets Sam, right? So there's this amplification. It's not beat for beat, but it is striking how much it is an amplification, almost beat for beat.
That's really insightful. I had not thought, I'd seen some of the similarities, but not thought of them all strung out like that. And it's just so quintessential Tolkien, right? He knows what he's doing and patterns all of these things after one another. We've talked about before how each of the members of the Fellowship have this death and resurrection motif that they go through, every one of them.
Oh yeah, we'll hit that. We'll hit that in detail at a later podcast.
There are so many of these symbols and motifs and things like that, that oh, I just love the mind of Tolkien. So let's then talk about the quest, because this is I think where we see the best kind of overlap between Frodo and Bilbo. Obviously, there's all the superficial stuff. There's even all the meaningful stuff, training him up and preparing him to go out and, you know, making him courageous and adventurous and all of this. But I think we see kind of paradigmatic moral example that Bilbo gives to Frodo when we look at the cracks of doom, when we see this final scene.
Oh man, we're going straight to the end.
Yeah, I mean,
oh boy.
We can talk about other things if you want, but this is what really captivates me as I've thought about it. Because we read this book every year, and so I get to see every year. Almost none of the sixth graders know the story because they haven't seen the movies for the most part. And so they don't know even the plot points of the narrative. And so they get to see for the first time, what? Frodo puts the ring on? He doesn't throw it in the fire? What's going on? Like, is he a failure?
I think all of my children cried at that scene. I think Benaiah ran around the room crying at that moment.
That's great. You're doing a great job. If that's your son's reaction to,
yep.
Yeah, that's appropriate in every way. You know, maybe not if he's 30 when he reads it for the first time. That would be a little much.
Yeah, but at
Benaiah's age, that's great. Yeah, that's right. It's this tragic, broken scene that is kind of inverted on its head. And so kind of the way I've talked about it is the way that other people talk about it all the time, which is, okay, Frodo is not a failure. He gets the ring to Mordor farther than probably anybody else could have possibly gotten it. And obviously with the help of Sam, they worked together to get it that far. And this shows what? It shows that Ilúvatar still has a part to play, right? That outside of the divine intervention, there can be no salvation for Middle-earth, which is fair. Is that traditionally how you've seen the scene kind of sketched out, or how you've thought about it?
That's right. That's right. Both highlighting Frodo's immense moral courage and stamina and fortitude, but also the inability of human will to solve the problem of evil. Right? It has to be divine intervention, divine or divine providence, working all things, even failure to the good.
So I want to caveat everything that comes after this by saying I'm not denying that at all. I think that's absolutely true. I think it's what Tolkien was doing intentionally. I just am not sure anymore that that's all he was doing. I'm not sure, in other words, that we're supposed to come away with this taste of failure from Frodo, you know, that this ultimate kind of letdown. I think he's actually drawing our minds intentionally back to other decisions that Frodo has made along the way.
Okay, I'm listening. Here we go.
Specifically, sparing Gollum, like Bilbo spares Gollum. So this is the moral example, right?
Right.
Bilbo spares Gollum knowing Gollum is treacherous. He's wicked. I could kill him now. You know, stab him in the back. I'm right here behind him. I'm invisible. He doesn't know I'm here. It would be easy to do. And he doesn't. And Gandalf tells us it's his pity that stays his hand, right? Pity for someone else who he recognizes is just wretched, is totally broken morally. And he pities him. So he doesn't put him to death, knowing this is a wicked creature who's going to continue to do wicked things. And he doesn't take it upon himself to be the judge. He doesn't take it upon himself to be the executioner. And Frodo learns his virtue, his morality from Bilbo, and does the same thing. I mean, there are probably several examples you could point to where, okay, it'd be justifiable to kill him now. We're like, come on, do it. Stop him from being so treacherous. And it's not just that they need a guide through Mordor, right? That could be accomplished other ways, maybe. But Frodo specifically says, you know, even when Sam suggests tying him up and leaving him, he even says, no, we can't do that, right? If we're going to kill him, we've got to kill him outright. We can't leave him to starve or to be eaten by the beasts or something like that. We've got to just do it if we're going to do it, but we can't do it. He recalls Gandalf's words. I mean, you can see this in a quote. I don't remember which chapter it's in, but you can see this in a quote. He recalls Gandalf's words about Bilbo sparing Gollum because of pity when he's thinking, I need to spare him. Right. I understand now the pity that Bilbo had. Now that Frodo's borne the ring, he's had the burden. Yeah, it's just a beautiful kind of parallel between them.
What's interesting there is that again, you have this amplification, right? So I think a key element in Frodo sparing Gollum is that he recognizes affinity with Gollum. He recognizes that you and I are linked. And in some ways, you are what I will become, unless, right? Frodo recognizes that he and Gollum are not that different, which Bilbo couldn't have recognized. Or maybe, as Gandalf points out, the shared riddles, right, and you know, similar anatomy, etc., could have given Bilbo some clue. But if so, Bilbo has this hazy guess of like this commonality, almost this shared humanity is the wrong word, right? But this almost shared humanity with Gollum. But Frodo knows it explicitly. And so he has Bilbo's example that the reality that Bilbo was faced with is now amplified again.
Yeah, I think it's amplified in another way as well. Gollum is spared by Bilbo in kind of a neutral state. Bilbo spares him because he thinks it's the right thing to do. He doesn't see any utility in the decision to spare him, in other words. He's already made it out of the mountain. He can see the light at the end of the tunnel, literally, and he's going to go and leave the mountain, and he's going to make it out. He doesn't need Gollum anymore, and he still spares him, even recognizing he's treacherous. Frodo spares him under greater circumstances, knowing, well, he needs a guide, sure, but again, right, he could go without a guide and hope to make it.
Well, he spares him at the beginning when he needs a guide, but he spares him again after he's betrayed them. And then at that point, he has no need for Gollum whatsoever.
Right, that's what I was going to say, right? He spares him knowing that Gollum wants the ring and he will likely try to kill me to take it. And despite the utility and the decision that it, you know, he could kill Gollum and accomplish something positive by protecting himself. I mean, that's why Sam wants to kill him, right? He's going to kill us in our sleep and take the ring. And Frodo spares him even at the end on Mount Doom. He looks at him and he pronounces this doom on Gollum. I think a literal doom, like words of prophecy on Gollum. If you touch me and try to take it again, it will be your death, right? And then that's what happens. And I think that is Frodo's moral victory, right? It's not that he doesn't fail at the end, that his last decision to hold the ring for himself isn't wrong, but his virtue that Bilbo has instilled in him and that he's cultivated leads him to consistently making good, virtuous, noble decisions that overcome the final bad decision that he makes, right? In other words, his life is not tainted or marred, and the world, for that matter, is not lost for this one bad decision. He's actually lived a life of virtue that overcomes that bad decision.
And there's an interesting, that's really interesting. I like it. There's other parallels that you could draw. You could say, or contrasts, you could say, Frodo doesn't do what Bilbo does. Bilbo gave up the ring willingly, Frodo doesn't, right? There's that contrast. But let's peel it deeper. I like you putting the moral weight not on giving up the ring or not giving up the ring, but you're placing the moral weight on the sparing of Gollum, which is a smaller, more obvious, more down-to-earth reality. Do I take the place of God and kill this creature in cold blood, so to speak, because I see all ends and I will do it? Or do I not? And you're saying that actually Frodo succeeded when he spared Gollum, and that was in continuity with Bilbo sparing Gollum. And you don't actually want to draw the contrast between the releasing the ring, the not releasing the ring, because, I don't know, maybe this is me being too harsh. I don't see Bilbo releasing the ring without Gandalf being there. I just don't see that happening, right? Gandalf prompts, pushes, coerces, no. But Gandalf provides strong support for Bilbo in making that decision to release the ring. And Gandalf wasn't there at the Cracks of Doom, right? But Gollum was. And so you see this strange, like, actually, that's a parallel. Bilbo maybe couldn't have released the ring on his own, but Gandalf provided what he needed. Frodo couldn't have released the ring on his own, and Iluvatar provides what he needs.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. I like the idea of Iluvatar providing what he needs to release the ring, right? Because he's calling back Frodo's past decision to come and bring it to bear on the moment, like we're talking about. But the fact that that's like him kind of giving Frodo the push that he needs, like Gandalf gives Bilbo the push, because Gandalf says explicitly, like, I couldn't take it from him. That would have done far greater harm, right? So he recognizes, I pushed him, I exhorted him, you know, it's a kind of harrowing scene for Bilbo because he sees Gandalf the Grey kind of starting to bring his power to bear in the moment. And yet he's not forced, right? He does actually release it willingly, and that's the whole point of Bilbo's character. I like that idea of Ilúvatar, through his intervention and sovereignty, bringing to bear Frodo's character in the present moment, despite this, you know, present moral failing. And also, just from a literary perspective, I think Tolkien had to do something like this. I mean, imagine the scene. Frodo makes it to the cracks of doom and drops the ring in the fire. Great. That's such an anticlimactic moment in the story. I think Tolkien just knew that's a false ending. That's a false narrative. That can't be what happens because of the build, because of the burden that it's been on Frodo. It can't just be like this final letting go and there's a gasp of clean air finally and everything works out. It has to be more complex than that, because the decision to throw the ring in the fire is clear. You should do that. Nobody's doubting that decision. Do it. Okay, he doesn't. What that reveals then is the complex decision, the multifaceted decision to spare Gollum, which a lot of people say, oh, why didn't he kill Gollum? That would be the obviously right thing to do. And Tolkien's highlighting, no, it wasn't the obviously right thing to do. It's more complex than that. And that has so much application for our lives.
Absolutely. That's gold. That's really good. And also, I don't think it's just about narrative complexity. I think it's about the gospel, right? I think that Tolkien is telling, like we said earlier, he's telling the story that actually human will is and striving and courage is not sufficient. Because if Frodo makes it, he trots up to the cracks of doom, bling, right? And it's all over. Then what's the point of the story? The point of the story is try really hard and evil will be overcome. And if you just go to these superhuman efforts to try really, really hard, that will save the day. Whereas with the story we actually get is that Frodo is being used by divine providence. And that divine providence uses his, or makes use of, his faithfulness in the small, harder, more complex, more human decisions. So I love that idea of Ilúvatar providing Frodo what he needs by means of his past faithfulness. May that be so for our stories as well. May God overcome our weakness with the fruits of our past faithfulness, which were also his mercy, right? And that's the story we see written again and again.
If I knew Pilgrim's Progress better, I would probably point to some examples from Pilgrim's Progress, because this is the same kind of thing that Christian authors do all the time, right? They draw on this idea that God, before time began, prepared good works to set before us that we might walk in them. Okay, so walk in them, right? And that path is so often one of the things that God uses to draw us back to the path. You know, you start to deviate, and something happens in some way, you know, metaphorically, we look back and see the past that we've been walking in, and it reminds us of the truth. It reminds us of the good. It reminds us what it means to get back on the path and walk forward again, you know, towards God, towards Christ's likeness. It's such an important idea that is, as you said, I think rightly, central to the gospel, that these are the ways that the Lord works in us and through us and bring salvation to bear on our bodies and souls.
And it's holding up both divine sovereignty and human agency in a wonderful way, right? That divine sovereignty is making use of human agency. And the means by which Frodo and the whole world is saved is the divine using of Frodo's agency.
Yes.
There's a great another example of this. Have you read much Stephen Lawhead?
Yeah, so I've read the first of the Pendragon cycle, and I'm working through, the Dragon King trilogy? I'm in the first book.
Oh, yeah, in the Hall of the Dragon King.
Yeah, in the Hall of the Dragon King.
There's a great work of his called Byzantium, which is this huge, long, haunting story about a monk that travels from Ireland to Constantinople to the Holy Roman Empire. Along the way, he's captured by Vikings, and then those Vikings end up taking him to Constantinople on a raid, right, through the the Black Sea. It's a great, great story. But anyways, he effectively witnesses to these Vikings, basically. And he provides, he's their introduction to Christ. Along the way, the monk loses his faith. Right? He becomes jaded. He's betrayed. He lives for revenge. He basically walks away from the faith. And then at the end, the very end, it's the Vikings who lead him back to Christ.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And it's this wonderful story. Same basic idea, that he fails, but God uses his past faithfulness to overcome his present failure. And that's just mercy. But it's mercy that makes much of human agency, that it matters what we do, and yet it's all in God's hands. Both are true. And I think we see that with Frodo beautifully.
That's so well said. And as a kind of side note, it's making me realize that, man, it's all in Tolkien, right?
It's all in Tolkien.
I've pointed so many people to the Silmarillion. I've heard others do this as well, that the first few pages of the Silmarillion have the best answer for the problem of evil that I've ever read, you know, outside of scripture itself, right? If you're going to try to explain to someone, what does it mean that God is sovereign and good and in control of all things and that evil exists, go read the Einar Lindele.
None can alter the music in my despite, but those changes to the music will end up being the most triumphant notes in my symphony, which is just...
It just gives you chills.
That's good.
Yeah. And so you're helping me realize not only does he have the best answer to the problem of evil, he also has the best harmonization of divine sovereignty and human agency, which is just beautiful. It's lovely. So it's all in Tolkien. Read it. Read The Lord of the Rings if you haven't. If you have, read it again. Well, I think we're coming up on time here, Josh. So let's give some book recommendations. What do you have for us this week?
Yeah, my book today is a little bit off the beaten path, maybe. A book by Leif Anger, who's perhaps best known for Peace Like a River, which is not the book I'm recommending today, but is wonderful as well. The book I'm recommending today is his second or third novel called So Brave, Young, and Handsome, which is a beautiful and very lyrical story of a failed author who ends up kind of on a whim accompanying an aged reformed train robber to go down to Mexico to apologize to his lost love. And it's a story about law and order and outlaws. So the title, So Brave, Young, and Handsome, describes this allure that outlaws have, but also the inherent tragedy of outlaws. It's about this failed author learning to be a man and learning how to be a man from this elderly train robber. It's gripping. It has some unforgettable scenes. The villain is this satanic in the most literal sense. Like, he's an accuser.
Yeah,
he's this relentless accuser of the aged train, of the reformed train robber. So it's this story of like the devil seeking to bring our sins against us, but a beautiful picture of the lifelessness that comes from accusing and the life that comes from repentance. Anyways, it's a delightful novel. Sad, beautiful. I highly recommend it. So Brave, Young, and Handsome, Leif Anger.
Yeah, that sounds great. I have not heard of that. And incidentally, I mentioned to you that I did find a copy of Cry the Beloved Country, so I've started into the introduction of that over the last week. I'm looking forward to it.
My wife is reading it right now, and I'm actually reading it to her, and it's her first time. I don't know how we've been married so long. Anyways, so wonderful.
Yeah, I got a nice old copy from the 60s. My book this week is Atomic Habits by James Clear. This is not written from a Christian perspective, particularly. It's a very practical book. It's built around the idea of building good habits and how do you form habits. There are a lot of people that write books about this sort of thing, and I think a lot of them get it wrong. He seems to have the right idea, which is that you need to envision the kind of person that you want to become, and then ask yourself, what does that kind of person do day to day? And how do you structure your day around becoming that kind of person or being like that kind of person, imitating that kind of person? And it's just eminently practical. No matter what stage of life you're in, no matter who you are, if you're struggling with the idea of having structure to your day and forming virtue through self-discipline and dying to your desires in the moment, dying to not even just the sinful desires, but like, oh, I want to sleep a little bit longer, or no, I don't really want to go on a bike ride, or whatever it is. And you realize that tends to lead you into sin of sloth, laziness, forgetfulness, whatever it is, neglect of your duties. This book is so helpful because it gives you just very practical, in your face instruction for, okay, this is how you're living. You want to change. What are you going to do about it? Do these things or stop talking about wanting to change. Right. He doesn't write it in that kind of polemic way. He writes it in a very encouraging way and very helpful way. But it is very polemic in the sense that it gets in your face if you're really dissatisfied with the habits that you're cultivating. So yeah, James Clear, Atomic Habits. It's great.
That's great. I've wanted to read that for so long, and I think you just pushed me over the edge, Jameson. I think I'm going to go and I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to read it because you just described me. So,
I think I just described all of us, really.
Dang it. Except for Bilbo.
Right, except for Bilbo. Yeah, it fits, right? What are the habits he trained in Frodo to make him faithful in the end? There you go. Nice segue. Well, that's all the time we have for today. If you enjoyed the show, you can follow us on Twitter at TreebeardPints. And you can see what we're writing about over on our Substack by following the link in the description of the show. We want to say thank you to Shane Caver for the use of our theme music. He actually wrote that for the show. And you can follow him on Spotify, also with the link down in the description. So I hope you've been blessed and edified by the show. And until next time.
Don't be hasty. You remember where you were when you discovered what Imperial meant? Everything was fine. It all went fine.